Lectionary Lab Live is recorded by Two Bubbas and a Bible live from Gainesville, Florida and Brasstown, North Carolina. Welcome, everybody, to the Lectionary Lab Live. I'm John Fairless. I'm here with my Bubba, Delmer Chilton. Say hey, Bubba.
Hey, Bubba.
Hey, man. Good to hear you today. Good to be back actually live. We enjoyed a couple of weeks of break and hope everybody was able to pick up some of our bonus material. I enjoyed listening to it. Appreciate Bob Mitchell being on the air with us last week. Of course, that was from 6 years ago, Bob, but thank you for your comments. We'll get your royalty check right out to you. But we're back today, getting back in the swing. These are the texts for the 13th Sunday after Pentecost, September the 8th, 2019. Bubba, I hope you got the cobwebs knocked off your notes and your comments. Tell me what you got going on today as we get ready to look at the gospel, another one of those texts that's, it'll push you a little bit today, and great supporting text. Let's talk about preaching this week.
As I've mentioned before, I used to have a volume. I think I donated it after retirement to one of the thrift stores around here, but it was a big, thick book called The Hard Sayings of Jesus. And this one is a really hard saying of Jesus. And it's difficult to figure out what's going on with some help from Fred Craddock. I would say that all four of the lessons in one way or another deal with what we've come to call, after the Bonhoeffer's book got very popular in the 50s, the cost of discipleship. And that's a sort of a shorthand for what some of the lesson work here today, and that's good. I think there's a key question that one has to play with, particularly with the Hebrew scripture material and somewhat with the gospel material, on the question of law and gospel, and to be careful of not making our proclamation for this day one of, if you do this, then you'll be saved. Because there is an if-then structure in Deuteronomy, but it's not what you might think. That's why I'm saying you got to be careful. You got to work on first and second use of the law, as we say. The first use is ordering human society. And I think a lot of what's in Deuteronomy, as Moses has laid this out, has to do with the first use. And Dorothy Sayers, in the book, The Mind of the Maker, in the early part of that, does a really good excursus on law. And law as the way the world is, and law as arbitrary decisions by someone with power. Those are two different things. And I think I'm bringing that up now because as we look, I'm going to start with the gospel in a minute, but that's an important thing. Childhood. I've got a 14-month-old grandson running around here, and I'm just about to move from don't to if you touch that, it will burn you.
Yeah.
Then. I didn't decide that I didn't want him touching it, so I'm going to punish him by burning him if he touches the stove. That's just the way the world is.
This is the way the world works. And yeah, I've come to understand it, not being schooled in the uses of the law, like you and our other good Lutheran friends. Choices have consequences. And those can be good choices, poor consequences. And it's more than just, though, a moral, I think this is what you're getting at. It's more than just this moral kind of teaching. The law here instructs us. The law teaches us. It guides us. This is the way
the world
works. And I think that's a helpful thing to realize.
That's what you're saying. I mean, you know, a bully says, if you step over that line, I'll hit you. If you step over that line, then I'll hit you. That's arbitrary. That's a bully. That's a decision. That's a punishment. That's a do what I ask. And or if you step over that line, you will be in quicksand, or that will collapse. That's the difference.
This if you step over that line, that's 1,000 feet down the side of that hill. You will fall. Yeah.
Let's keep those two things in mind. And like I said, Dorothy Sayers, if you can probably find it in the library somewhere, Mind of the Maker, is a really excellent look at the issue of creativity in God and the Trinity being exposed and the issue in how one creates. It's a really interesting book. So I'm going to go back now to the gospel, 14:25-33. And they got this business about hating people. So it's difficult. So let's address this. So whenever something starts with therefore or now, say, well, what happened before that? But this is a turn. The rest of chapter 14 is kind of semi-private conversations. It starts off with he's going to a meal at the house of the leader who's a Pharisee, and he has questions about, is it legal to heal on the Sabbath? Not the story we had previous, but on the front one. Mm-hmm. And then the one from last week about come up higher, or whom are you going to invite? Now, these are in this gathering and to this teacher, these leaders. That now, large crowd. So this is general discussion. This is important. This is to everybody. And what's happening here, notice it says, whoever comes to me in verse 26, whoever comes to me. Up until then, there's been a lot of follow me, you come. And then there's been a few folks who came up and said, I'll go with you anywhere. And he's told them what? The cost of discipleship. Now the large crowd is getting bigger and people are following around behind him. And he just wants to make it really clear that this ain't no parade. This ain't no party. Remember chapter 9 following, he's on his way to the cross, he's on his way to Jerusalem, he's on his way to death, he's been telling people, so he's trying one more time to make sure they understand what it is they're in for if they want to follow. He's trying to make it clear. Now, the word hate here is very, very difficult to deal with. Craddock says, and I'm going to own a quote, this is a Semitic way of expressing detachment, of turning away from, of not, and then it goes on to say in his commentary, this is not about detesting, abhorring, an emotional response.
Correct.
Because that would put the lie to everything else that's said about love. They're just too contrasting. This word hate here is like in Proverbs 13:24. Where it talks about he who spares the rod hates the child. But if you love the child, you will discipline the child. And you know, I don't want to get into any discussions of corporal punishment. What he's saying there is not indulging your children is not loving them. It's not caring enough about them to raise them right.
Yeah, and it's sometimes hard for us in English, and especially when we bring contemporary connotations to words like hate.
Yeah,
boy, that's a really strong word, and it's got a lot of juice in our current usage. Yeah. But to take a minute, do a little work. Yeah, this is absolutely a term that was quite frequently used in evaluating, and so. Well, I value this thing or this person a little higher than that. It's about making, you hate to say love less, but sort of intensity. Something's got to be the most important. And so this is a challenge to us. I see it in continuity with the stories we've been reading a couple of weeks ago when you mentioned the healing story.
Yeah.
Particularly the woman bowed over
yep.
In the synagogue that day. And Jesus essentially sets before them what's more important, keeping the rules or blessing the life. It's this weighing, okay? And so you could say in that instance, for example, he loved the woman more than he loved the decorum of the synagogue.
Right, right.
He hated it. By comparison, he hated the decorum of the synagogue. So, yeah, you're right. It's a distinguishing term.
Don't you just hate it when that happens? I mean, we use this language all the time for a variety of things. You just used it. I hate to say this, but nobody.
I hate to say this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you have to think about how the language is used. And that, I think, if you're going to read this text with Jesus saying hating people, you've got to address it. This is one thing, whatever shape, form your sermon may take, this may be a time to break form and talk about this no matter what else you do. You know what I mean? You've got to, because people are going to be sitting there unable to hear anything else you say because they're saying, what does Jesus mean I got to hate mama and them? Mm-hmm. For those of you not from the American South, mama and them is an expression that means all of your relatives and friends, all your family. Mm-hmm. So what do you mean I got to hate mama and them? Mm-hmm. And they're not going to be able to get much further. So you got to address that and find some analogies that work for your context that help people see this is really more about if you do not value the gospel, the kingdom of God, more than you value your family, cannot follow me. And that's the second thing I want to talk about here. Now, Miss Collins and my second grade teacher at Red Bank Elementary would probably be in deep trouble in the modern world, but in 1962, she was allowed to whack you over the head with plastic rulers and break them in the interest of instruction.
There you go. I got whacked on other spots.
Well, besides my head. She had these. They were thin plastic, and they'd break easily.
I can still see them.
But if you said "can" when you should say "may," you got whacked pretty good. And to this day, I cringe a little when I almost say "can I" when I mean "may I." So
here comes Miss Collins.
Here comes Miss Collins. So when Jesus says, whoever does not hate father, mother, et cetera, cannot be my disciple, this is the first use of the law. He is describing reality, not making a rule. If he had said, may not be my disciple, Jesus just said, well, what criteria do I want to have? And this is one I want. I want them to love me more than they love their families. That's not what he said.
Correct.
And you go through the number of cannots in here. There's like 4.5, I call it. Because one of them stated differently, does not, and all of that. He goes through, and you just can't. That's just it. You can't.
This is in a similar vein.
Yeah.
To Sermon on the Mount, Sermon on the Plain, cannot serve two masters.
That's right.
Or what we might say, you can't walk in two directions at the same time.
Yeah, that's right.
There's a choice to be made. I can walk to the left or I can walk to the right, but other than in a strange quantum experience, I cannot walk both left and right.
Well, and the other part is then to say both of these illustrations he uses here are illustrations of the issue, not of may not of volition, but of ability. Mm-hmm. And he's basically saying you can't build a tower if you don't have enough money. Mm-hmm. Anybody's ever bought a house? You just can't buy it if you don't have the credit.
But I really like that house. I really want to move into that one.
Or, yeah, as he puts it, you can get underwater, you can get a loan somehow, and then you can't pay for it, you're going to lose it. Same thing with the analogy about going to war. It's you can't do it. There's what I always like to say is this statement is descriptive. It describes reality. and it's not prescriptive. Jesus isn't prescribing anything. He's not restrictive. It's not restrictive. He's not restricting you arbitrarily. He's just describing reality. This is what I'm doing. This is where I'm going. And this is, you're going to follow me. That's consistent with a multitude of things he said about not having a home, nowhere to lay your head, and all this kind of stuff. You got to take up the cross and follow me, which means leaving some other things behind. Yep. And then, but interestingly, he gets to the end. Now, it started about does not hate father and mother, et cetera, et cetera. But he gets to the end with his therefore, his conclusion. If you do not give up all your possessions, which nobody's mentioned possessions except, you know, maybe in the building of the tower. And that's the same, but it's connected because your place in your family is a part of your possessions. Giving up that relationship with your family, which is security, is the same as giving up your possessions. So ultimately he's talking about if you have to be you have to let go of security and take the cross that becomes your security, but it's a dangerous security.
Again, in these last several weeks, we've had a number of things that have had as part of their sort of rootedness in the gospel message, the idea that I possess it.
Yeah.
I hold on to it. I control it.
Yeah.
And Jesus has talked about the fact of letting those things go. And this gets at that illusion of control, that illusion of possession. It's mine. And gets at what we often talk about, and people turn their brains off as soon as they hear the word stewardship.
Yeah.
But we are not possessing this life. We are given it
right
by God. And as a disciple, we use it, we receive it, we manage it, but it's not mine. It, you know, whether it's my money, my kids, my children, my grandchildren, no, they're not mine. I don't possess them. Yeah. And it puts us back in a relationship of trust.
Right.
Can God be trusted? And that reminds me, just a moment ago, I thought of this, the great Liston Mills that we quote all the time. One day I remember asking Dr. Mills if I could speak with him after class, and we were talking, and something was going on in my congregation, and I was, you know, going on and on and on about, well, you know, this is happening and I'm going to have to do this and I'm going to have to do this. And I was upset about it. And I said, I just don't have any choice.
You always
Dr. Mills leaned back in his classic way, and he said, well, no, I don't think that's exactly true. You can choose not to do so. You always have a choice. And I was like, oh, yeah. And so there's something about the tighter I'm tied into thinking that that I possess this, that I control this situation, the more I feel like, well, I have to do this thing, and letting go, I begin to realize, well, no, I don't really have to follow Jesus. I can turn these other ways. I don't really have to so tightly try to manage and control my relationships, my life, my stuff.
Well, one of the dynamics that goes on and misunderstandings of what in its extreme form is predestination kind of thing, which we don't talk about that much, is to think that God has already decided who's saved and who's not, in a language I don't much use anymore. Therefore, as we say, as Paul said, does that mean we should sin the more that grace may abound? It doesn't matter what we do, and that's it. The question is, if our eternal relationship with God, God's love, is unchanged by what we do, then we can let go of all these efforts to prove, to secure ourselves and to prove that we're worthy to God or we're worthy to the world. We can let go of all of that, let go of that security, and live life by other standards that have nothing to do with security, because our security is with God. That's the part of grabbing onto the cross. So that's the value of that notion, that there's nothing we do that makes God love us. If you think, well, there's nothing I can do, and God loves us and forgives me no matter what, then I am freed from all that. I can let go of all of that and start thinking about, how do I live a life authentically following Christ without worrying about that other result?
And like so many things, first reading of, oh, I got to let go, I got to give up all my stuff, got to let go of my position, sounds so constrictive and sounds so, but the more you understand what's going on, you go, wait a minute, the opposite is true.
Right.
Talk about freedom.
Talk about freedom.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, we better look at some of these other texts.
And Psalm right quick, because they're, you know, so the same stuff applies. Now, this is a very clear end of the book of laws, you know, discussing the commandments, and it just lays all this out. And so it's set up as Moses' sermon. This is a sermon. This is a pound away. This is the conclusion. This is the exhortation to choose, you know. And I've always loved that line out of 30:19. So choose life.
I call heaven and earth to witness against you today. Boy, that's a proclamation right there.
So it's classic, has a classic if-then structure. You know, it lays it out in two choices, as you say. You know, you got life and prosperity, death and adversity. You can just go through here, all this stuff that gets laid out. I was thinking down in 30:18, you shall not live long. And I was thinking, oh, you know, I know the guy that played Spock, Leonard Nimoy.
Leonard Nimoy.
You know, he got his the fingers divided, got the blessing from the synagogue and experience. And I was thinking, wonder if he got live long and prosper from this text. May you live long and prosper from his background in Judaism. But so you've got this if-then structure with clear reward and punishment. And it looks like if you take this as God laying down the law, then it becomes, one of those things we just resist. You know, we don't want to say, well, I've got to do all this stuff or God's going to get me. That's not what it says. No.
This is the way the world works.
This is the law. This is the way the world works. These laws, these commandments, this teaching I'm giving you will aid you through life. This, if you follow this, life will mostly be better. And if you don't, it'll be kind of bad. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you look through it, you take some of the cultic and ritual stuff and sort of, you know, and realize that's to support the life of the community and life in community. Ultimately, you look at it and you say, well, yeah. You know, it's, if we don't kill, we don't steal, if we honor one another, you know, all those things, we're not taking it. Well, yeah, life's better. We all understand that, you know. This is the root of Fulghum's book that was so popular back in the 70s and 80s, Everything I Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. And basically, if you do these things, then life is better. Mm-hmm. This is the key of what he's talking about here. And it's extreme language. I declare to you today, you shall perish. You will not live long in the land. Well, remember, these are people who have been, in the story, were slaves, and then they were wandering. They're about to go in and try to be a state, a community, settled. And he's basically saying, God has given you this gift of how to live together in prosperity. And all I can do is say, if you follow this, it'll be good. If you don't, it's not going to work out very well.
Don't forget who you are. Don't forget whose you are.
Yep.
Because he's warning them. Look, you get out there in the land and you're going to hear about other gods and other ways of living, and there's going to be other things. Remember where you've come from. Remember, you know, who got you here. Remember whose you are. You've talked before, and both of us have. You know, we got the kind of life lesson. As you begin to grow up at home and you begin to gather in the world, and the parents say to you, now, son, you need to remember you're a Chilton. yeah. you know, or you're a fearless and you representing your family out there, you know, the, however we all kind of got there. There's an element to that here. I think.
My daddy liked to do it in an oxymoronic method, though I doubt he knew that word. He'd say, remember you're a Chilton and don't think you are somebody. Which I understood.
I've quoted my grandmother before. Now, don't go getting too big for your britches.
That's right. That's right.
So, yeah, but yeah, you're right. This is a connectionship. This is a connection to a relationship with the God of the Exodus, with the God of Israel, with the God of the patriarchs, if you will. Do not forget whose you are.
And this is,
In a minute, when we get to Philemon, I want to talk about how, because I'm going to be preaching Philemon, going through the epistles this month. And so there's something in these texts about fundamental relationships and how they are reordered, rebalanced sometimes. To me, this is a call to for Israel to remember their fundamental relationship to God.
It is and is not connected to eternal salvation. It isn't in the sense of the if you do this then you'll be saved.
Correct.
But it is connected in that in the Hebrew scriptures, it is relationship with God is a communal thing. And you live it out in community, which is also reflected in, then, of course, the New Testament. You go to Psalm 1. It's one of those delight in the law kind of psalms. I just want to point out you could play around with the kind of an if-them structure. And on one side, if you go through and mark up, you got happy, delight, prosper, fruitful, watches over. And on the other side, you've got language like sinners, scoffers, wicked, chaff. Perish, wither. This is again that choice, and it has, and it's a commentary, basically, I think, on Deuteronomy about what it means to be follow the teaching of God. So we'll move over to Philemon, and I got a few quick things, and then you do your thing.
I'll wrap it up. There you go.
So it's 21 verses, and it falls out by thirds to me. It is to me a classic bit of pastoral persuasion.
A good bit
of pastoral persuasion.
Paul's good at this stuff.
The first third is all this nice greetings and praise and heaping on the fertilizer, I would say. And he's just, you know, it's just laudatory and all of this. And then verse 8, he hits his request for this reason. And for the next, few verses up through 14, he has his request, and he doesn't make a law. He makes a request, and I think you should do this. And then in the last third, he just starts doing the guilting and twisting. He wasn't worthless, and now he's valuable both to me. It wasn't worth anything to anybody. Now he's valuable to you. He's used to be, you know, cussing. Now he's a brother, and I'm like his father, and it's like my son. And remember, if it weren't for me, you wouldn't be saved. And all this stuff he does. I think it's important. One of the as you look at this text and think of our recent the history in America, just plain out history in America of racism, and slavery wasn't attached to race until the American colonies, really. And an important date, 1667, the Virginia Assembly passed a law for the colony that was very important, because English custom had been that you could not keep a Christian as a slave because you were brothers and sisters. And the Virginia Assembly passed a law that said, that wasn't necessarily the case, because they'd been deciding not to evangelize their slaves because they didn't want to turn them free. So they made a choice that says, just because you become Christian doesn't mean you don't have to turn them free, and cited this text that Paul did not tell him to turn him loose. That's an unfortunate history of this text. I think Paul was right in this context. This is one thing. Don't take a text out of context and make a pretext out of it. Mm-hmm. In this mm-hmm. case, Paul knew what he was doing and knew this was the best way to approach this person he knew. And I have no doubt that manumission followed this letter. I have I'm no doubt. But it's history in the American South, an American country. I mean, the whole country, there was slavery from New England to Georgia and all across in this country for years. And the unfortunate result was that proof texting folks went to this text to say, well, it would be good, but you don't have to. And that one, you know, so that's my,
just take care of him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a great point. And for me, I'm working with this Philemon text, and it is situated in all of the other texts. There is this issue of relationship and choices we make in relationships and valuing. And this is an example, I believe, Paul is asking Philemon to reevaluate, to consider rebalancing the relationship with Onesimus, who's been this slave. And of course, there's a play on words with useless and useful, and his name meant useful. And I know he was useless. He ran away, no good, no count, but he's been useful to me, and I know he's useful to you. And then that key, he never quite commands him,
right,
but he does say, receive him back no longer as a slave, but more than a slave.
Right.
A beloved brother. And so the gospel calls us sometimes to reevaluate relationships and to rebalance. And I think that's certainly the central moment in Jesus saying, look, you know, in order to follow me, you're going to have to rebalance how you consider father, mother, sister, brother, all this other stuff in your life. It's going to shift relationships, not only to people, but to stuff and to life situations and so on. I think that's what you hear Moses in the sermon,
right,
coming in Deuteronomy. You guys are going to have to consider these relationships, and you're going to be distracted by all kinds of other things. So that's part of what the gospel is doing in us, re-evaluating, rebalancing, shifting. And who are we in Christ? And again, Jesus has talked about who's our neighbor and so on and so forth. It's about what happens in us.
Yeah.
And we begin to see people. We begin to see the world. We begin to see things that are happening and our relationships to all of these things differently.
Yeah.
So the gospel will upset a feller's apple cart from time to time.
It will. And one other thing, as you read through this, it's really hard from our perspective to not undersee that Paul is basically saying, I expect you to free him. Confident of your obedience, let me have this a benefit from you. But here's the key, one of the keys. We have to examine our own scales on our eyes as we read things, and the slaveholders who had a vested interest in American slavery could read this and say, well, the Bible doesn't say that. It actually, you know, because they brought that they were almost unaware of to the text. The question is, what do we bring to text that keep us from hearing the word as descriptive and of the word of gospel inside of it that calls us?
One of the most important relationships we'll continually need to re-evaluate and re-examine and rebalance is our relationship to ourselves.
Yep.
And that's why I always, when I go back to what we call that great commandment, love God with all your heart, love your neighbor as yourself. Don't forget, the gospel causes me to have to look in myself. So What am I bringing to the text? That's a great question. Well, Bubba, we've chewed it over. We're running just a little over time. I guess we're just enthusiastic to get back at it today. It's been good, and we'll be back next week as we continue to discuss these great texts. But I reckon for today, there's not much left for us to do other than to tell everybody bye.
Everybody bye.
Lectionary Lab Live is a Two Bubbas and a Bible production. Our opening theme is Sally Gooden, performed by Nat Keefe and the Bowties. We go out today with the gospel hymn Follow, Follow On. The text is by W.O. Cushing, the tune composed by Robert Lowry.